And welcome to a special edition of Third Degree Burn. I'm your host, Kirk Greenfield, and we're joined by our usual cast of experts. I'm going to go alphabetically here and start with Tim Elliott.
Hello.
All right, then let's go around. We're going to get to John Hyatt.
Hey there.
And Fred West.
Hello, true believers.
And Nigel from Japan.
Hello there.
And today is going to be are we calling this coffee and comics or cocktails and comics?
I believe it's a cocktail, cocktails and comics.
Okay. We're going to have a round table discussion. Rather than focusing on one particular issue, Brian had a strong passion that he wanted to discuss a particular year in comics and discuss whether it was a peak of sorts. And as Brian is reconnecting with the call, yes, hello, Brian. Say hello.
Hey, oh, I'm doing great. How's it going?
So I was just mentioning your idea to take a look at a particular year and have us discuss the various things that came out. Do you want to take it from here and explain your concept?
Well, yeah. I mean, a while back, I had taken a look at, in movies, the year 1982, and realized that that was like just one of the greatest years for movies ever, with everything that came out there. And I mean, just as two movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Blade Runner. Now, back at the time, it wasn't necessarily considered the greatest year. But as years have gone on, people look at that year and just go, wow, that's amazing. And I was sitting here and I was reading a certain book. And I just, what year did that come out? And I'll go, oh, yeah. Hey, wait a minute. What else came out that year? And then all of a sudden, it just started to come together. And I was seeing all these different things. And yeah, I'll list off, We did have a lot coming into it just before. Like in 84, they had the original Secret Wars. 85 had Crisis on Infinite Earths and sadly Secret Wars 2. And as we went into 86, it was like all of a sudden a watershed of different books of all different types and so many things that happened that was just like crazy. Now January, going into January, we had Daredevil's Born Again series, which is, Frank Miller taking Daredevil through, the run. And in 1986, Frank Miller was just like exceptionally busy. So he did Born Again, he did Batman The Dark Knight Returns, and Batman Year One. And all that was in one year. And you sit there and you look at that and you go, God, is that all there? I mean, that's enough right there, right? Well, we also had Watchmen that started in September.
Woohoo!
We had the Mutant Massacre happening all through the Mutant books. Legends started in November, and we also had Man of Steel coming out. We had John Byrne leaving Marvel after finishing his run on Fantastic Four and his run on the Hulk, which all still bled into the beginning of 1986. And then, of course, George Perez's Wonder Woman. And I believe, and I could be wrong on that, but Mike Barron's The Flash, I think, started towards the end of the year. But, I mean, those aren't just a couple of the things that happened in that year. The Killing Joke came out in April of that year. You had more of the Hobgoblin mystery going on in Amazing Spider-Man. You had the Invisible Woman's power focus and the return of Jean Grey. You had, I mean...
The new universe started.
The new universe started. John Romita Jr. left the X-Men and went to Starbrand, which is, in my opinion, the only book that really held water amongst all the other
movies. No, DP7 was pretty good. DP7 was pretty good, I thought.
Well, there were certain books in virtually every one of the series that had standout issues. I mean, Night Mask had a real nice issue, I think Keith Giffen did.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought was interesting, but
it's also Night Mask is Mark Bagley's first work, I believe, at Marvel.
Yeah, and Mark Bagley also did one issue of Starbrand. Now, and the first six issues of Starbrand, that was Jim Shooter and John Romita Jr. And it was writing that I think just asks to be reread. If you're a kid and you read Starbrand when it first came out, and then as a young adult you read it, you got something different out of it. As a full adult, you got something exceptionally different out of it. And as a senior citizen, you look back and you're just like, what the framistatin whippersnapping things going on here? I was really surprised by Jim Shooter's writing of that particular series. But I think it was very personal for him. But I mean, the point that I'm making here is that this year just had, I'd say, probably some of the greatest runs ever. Also in this is when the Bill Sienkiewicz had left the New Mutants. And so you had guys like Keith Pollard come in and Jackson Gweiss with Kyle Baker doing the inks, and you got to see some really different storytelling there. And it was probably some of the best era of the New Mutants, as far as I'm concerned, though I stopped reading late in the Brett Blevins era. Because Louise Simonson was writing it then. But I mean, again, I'm just sitting there looking at this one year and I'm so astounded by the things that happened. Can you guys remember? Well, let me just take you back a little bit further, all right? In 1982 is when I discovered my first comic book shop, and it was called Fantastic Worlds. And it was comic book shops as, you know, everybody knew them when they were kids. There were hole in the walls. You had a grumpy, cantankerous guy running the place. And usually very young kids got looked side-eyed when they came into the shop. I came in, you know, at 16, and within a couple of months, they said they were going to close the store there and move it to a different place, and they did. And
expand it, you mean?
Yeah, he moved to a much larger location and it just became a much nicer shop. And it wasn't just him running the shop. Now, the guy that owned it and ran it was a guy named Bob Wayne. Are you familiar with the name Bob Wayne?
Well, he alter ego of Batman.
Bruce.
Oh, sorry.
His brother.
Well, actually, Bob Wayne's got a bit to do with Batman. See, Bob Wayne got sold his shop He went to work for DC. Or actually Warner Brothers, in public relations. So in 1989, when Batman with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson came out, he's touring cross-country to all the comic conventions and showing the video clips and everything, the trailers and whatnot, and answering any questions anybody had about Batman. But he started out in just a little comic book shop right here in Texas. But when the shop expanded, and again, I'm going back to 1986, and I remember the shop was just like in its perfect, it was not quite what you see in the comic book shops now. You didn't have statues and such, but you did have a lot of posters and a lot of interesting things showing up, like the indie work, like you saw Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when it came out. And now I need to go and look at what year that came out to see if that's the same year if that came out in 86. But I just remember that my friends and I, again, in 86, I was 20 years old. I was going to college, but I had disposable cash, so I was spending a good bit, like $60 a drop at the comic book shop. And so I was buying any and every book and hitting every back issue that I could possibly get that was interesting. It was, I mean, again, it was a fun time for me. So that, of course, adds a lot more to the enjoyment of this. But it was just that time. And it's funny because Bob Wayne actually offered me a job at the shop. And I turned it down because I was just afraid that my schoolwork would suffer.
Gee, that was right.
Oh, yeah.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was 1984, I believe.
No, I wouldn't be surprised. I remember that there was actually a book that came out called Gobbledygook that had them in there. And I think that came out either the same month or the month before Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number one was released. But and my friend Lawrence snatched every issue of that book up as soon as they came out. And I wonder if his kids realized that they got their college funds right there. Unfortunately, my friend, he passed away in 2016. But anyway.
I have a tangent on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that I can share. Stop me if I've told you this before, but it was in about 1986 or so that one of the two, Eastman and Laird, I'm not sure, maybe it was Eastman, had come to a convention, comic convention in Dearborn, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, and living and working in Detroit at the PBS TV station there. I had a couple of years earlier ordered, based upon a classified ad in a teeny tiny classified ad in the back of Comic Buyer's Guide newspaper, for a very tongue-in-cheek listing that was called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1, you know, send $1.25 to this address. So, you know, that was an outrageous amount back then, but I went ahead and did it. And so I got a manila envelope back, and sure enough, there was a copy of number one in it. Trying to think if that's where I bought number two from. I don't remember. Maybe number two had shown up in the comic shops, but at any rate, I had this copy of the first issue, and I thought, oh, this is pretty clever, ties into Daredevil. You know, I was very pleased, very satisfied with it, a black and white book. So I put it back in the manila envelope and in the side of a half sized box. And in 1986, went to the Dearborn Convention with it tucked under my arm, walked up in line to have him sign it, and set it down on the table. And sure enough, as he got ready to sign it, I pulled the thing out, and he freaked out. He was beside himself. He said, oh, my God, you've got it. You're one of the original, I think he said 600, but I can't swear what number he said, but you're one of the original 600. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he says, you ordered this through the mail. And I said, yeah, how can you tell? And he says, because that manila envelope that you have has the return address for our studios that we were in when we produced the first run, the first printing. Oh, and wow. We were only there for 3 months. So you have proof that you got one of the originals, and the envelope is probably worth more than this comic is. So I was flummoxed. I was like, you're kidding. I just tucked it in there to save it, to protect it. So he went ahead and signed the book, but he told me this story, and I walked out of there feeling pretty good about myself. So that's my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle story. I can't remember which of the two creators it was, or exactly how many he said that they mailed out, but it was only the first printing, and so I guess I financed the start of the empire.
Do you still have that book, Kirk?
No, I sold it within a year or two. I believe I sold number one and I sold number two together for $100 or something, which at the time was a princely sum.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't really invest in it. I didn't buy it to invest in it, and I wasn't really playing the investor's market, but it didn't fit in a box. It didn't. It was awkward because it was not quite standard comic book size at the time, and now, it was still pretty hot, and it was signed. So I put an ad in the back of Comic Buyer's Guide newspaper, and I sold it to somebody, and they sent me a money order, and I mailed it to them. Wow. And that's my Turtles story. That's the sum total of my involvement. I've never had any toys or watched any of the movies or done anything else with it.
That was the first issue with the white and it was black and white with a kind of reddish
hue
on the cover.
Yes.
And now it's like $19,000 going for 19.
Oh, thank you. I really needed to hear that.
Well, Kirk, it says those. Yeah, it says it ranges from $3,000 to over $245,000.
Wow.
That Jesus. Book.
$245,000 if you had that envelope, Kirk.
You know, I'm pretty sure that I took it out of the envelope when I mailed it to somebody, but tell you the truth, I don't recall. Maybe I kept it in the envelope to protect it when I put it in some sort of a mailer to mail to the guy, but that's, I was surprised that he reacted so strongly because I couldn't figure out what was thrilling him so much until he explained the return address that he recognized it and it meant something for him. He was very excited about seeing it.
Well, that's pretty cool. And, I mean, there are so many stories you can sit there and tell from those days when you were doing that. I was sitting there thinking about Starbrand. And there was the guy that worked at that comic book shop. His name is Weldon Adams, and he's a friend of the show. He actually works at Heritage Auctions now. And they're the guys that just sold that big float of Byrne original art a couple of years back, including the big double splash page from the Fate of the Phoenix. And I just remember him when the shop was in its heyday, the lead writer from Forward Star Telegram goes and does an article on Weldon and just his, you know, comic book knowledge and everything. And I was like in there in the shop and I was talking to him, to Weldon about Starbrand, and he referred to it as Green Lantern Brand.
What?
And, yeah,
it is. It's basically Green. Yeah, green. It's Green Lantern.
Yeah, it's got the similar origin. Yeah.
Okay.
And as he's sitting there talking to me, I noticed the issue of the Star Telegram with Weldon's picture on it. I said, "Oh, wow, they did an article on you." And he goes, "Yeah, the article's pretty good." I said, "Well, that's good, because normally the Star Telegram's a rag." And this guy on the other side of me just kind of walks out the door right then, and Weldon goes, "That's the guy that wrote the article about me." So apparently I have a very bad timing when it comes to that guy and Al Milgrom. But again, I mean, do you guys have any, do you remember getting these books, or did you at the time sit there and think, man, there's just so much really good stuff coming out?
Yes, I remember. I think it was spring of, maybe I'm thinking spring of 87. Dark Knight Returns was coming out. I would get it. I'd pick it up on a Sunday evening and go home. And I think it was August. It was terribly, terribly warm in Detroit. And I would sit in my skivvies in my Lazy Boy chair with one light on over my shoulder. And I remember reading it and thinking, you know, I would sit down and I read it cover to cover. It would take me about 45 minutes. And when I put it down, I'd go, wow, what a comic. What a time to be alive. Mm. And I think it was, I did that with the first three of the four Dark Knight Returns books. So, yes, I remember how great it was and that Watchmen was coming out. I believe I moved out of Detroit to Salt Lake City in 87, and we had gotten something like 11 of the 12 Watchmen issues by then. So Watchmen must have been coming out that year, and I was there for each one and just thinking, where is this going?
Yeah.
I had no idea what the plot was supposed to be or what I was supposed to be getting out of this. Mm-hmm. But I knew it was something unlike anything else I had seen. So, you know, I remember now when you describe all the things that were happening that year. Yeah, you're right. It was a high watermark.
I remember not picking up Dark Knight because I was a full-blown Marvel guy, and I didn't pick it up until the fourth issue just because I kept hearing so many people talking about it. So I missed out in the first three. I picked up number four. I tended to do that. Like Star Wars, I picked up, you know, because Star Wars ended in 86. I picked up that issue. Power Man Iron Fist ended. I picked up that last issue, you know, coming at the tail end of all this stuff. But 86 is what kind of got, because as you said, Brian, we got Man of Steel, we got Burns, you know, jump to DC. So I jumped with him. So I started, you know, reading Man of Steel, then Superman started. I didn't read, I think I did the same with Crisis. I picked up the very final issue because I wasn't reading it. I didn't know anything about it, but everybody kept talking about it. I'll pick it up, see what it's all the fuss is about. And he did all that. Action Comics started. He started doing that. Man of Steel, Legends. So he was doing gangbusters over there at DC. So I kind of went along with him and started occasionally, mostly picking up Superman stuff.
Yeah. Well, golly, there's so much that I keep remembering is going on. The mystery of the Hobgoblin was also a big thing in the Spider-Man books.
Yes. That was a great run.
February of 86 was the year Booster Gold started.
Yep.
Now what started?
Booster Gold.
Booster Gold, yeah. Holy cow.
I mean, that was, and I remember going, who's this guy? What the heck's going on? You know, kind of thing. And but it was a novel innovation of a superhero. And, you know, he's still around today. He's getting his own TV series or something right now. So,
yeah. And then there was the Scourge of the Underworld.
Yeah. Was that that year?
That was revealed in Captain America.
Yes, possibly. Yeah.
And I think you had the Sinister Syndicate attacking Spider-Man and Silver Sable. Didn't she start up around that time? Cause she was in one of the issues there.
She was there earlier, I think.
But it was also the 25th anniversary of Marvel. And so I think in November, you got every book had a cover where you had all the heroes around them.
Yeah,
mugshot. The mugshot type covers.
And frame covers. I understand they're really collectible these days. If you can get them all.
Yeah, actually, there's one book that collects all of them. And there's so many things I'm finding at the comic book shop now that's like really, really cool. They've actually put out an omnibus of Marvel Age. So you can get the entire series of Marvel Age in omnibus form.
Who read Strike Force Mortari?
I read
some of those.
That's a good series. It had nothing to do with Marvel Universe. It's completely independent. But it was a good story. The artwork is pretty good.
Yeah.
Incredibly creative and a very novel experience. And it keeps coming back into my, you know, radar every once in a while. It's like, oh, I got to find that again and read some more of that kind of thing. So, yeah, that was a great series.
It reads almost like you could see that being transplanted into an HBO series today. Superheroes totally. Who have a limited lifespan and they volunteer for the, you know, that's the gist behind it.
Yeah.
Was it a 12-issue maxi series or an ongoing title?
I thought it was ongoing, but it didn't run very long.
It was ongoing, but it didn't, like 30 issues, 40 maybe.
Maybe.
It kind of got strange at the end. Like, I didn't think it ever got an appropriate wrap up on the storyline.
It kind of lost its way.
I think it should be.
Well, did any of them survive to the end? Because, I mean, the whole point of it was that they got these superpowers and they died quickly.
They died after a year.
After a year, yeah.
Yeah.
And so your group of heroes changed all the time, which was a novel experience. But I think the idea of having to rebuild a new set of heroes and not do something that was already done in Marvel and DC, I could see that would be like exhausting after a period of time, you know, to have these characters come in and live this sheer lifespan. And wasn't it supposed to be like in real time kind of thing? So you'd only have them for a little bit of time.
I don't remember that. I know the new universe was that way. It was supposedly a month would pass in between each issue, which I think they abandoned that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of like Logan's Run, isn't it? You live fast, only young people survive, and you hit the your clock goes off, and it's like you're done.
Yeah. Well, you know, you volunteer because Earth's being invaded by these big aliens. I can't remember what they're called, and you volunteer to get superpowers, knowing you're going to live for a year because it's going to kind of burn you out. But you're volunteering to help save the planet.
Yep.
Who read the? Because this ended. Who read the Punisher Limited series? That ended in 86. Started in 85.
Five issues in a four-issue limited series.
The 4/5 issue, yeah.
Yeah.
Where some fantastic, that's what turned me on to Mike Zeck. I love the artwork.
Yeah, that really, really awesome stuff there. And I remember when that came out and I was getting that every issue. And then I remember reading the fourth issue and it said to be continued or concluded. And I'm like, wait a minute. And all of a sudden they came out with issue 5.
Well, and that's also the limited run that pumped up the value of Spider-Man 129, which I'd never bought. It was expensive to them, but not super expensive. And then suddenly the Punisher becomes super hot, and that issue just became unobtainable.
Did Alan Moore put out Miracle Man in 86?
I know he was on Swamp Thing.
He did Swamp Thing, but yeah, it looks like Miracle Man for Eclipse Comics was a new series in 86. Well, I remember reading that.
That was a reprint of Marvel Man, is what it was written. It was released as in Great Britain.
Yeah.
And they couldn't use the Marvel name, so they made it Miracle Man when they printed it out here. So Moore had written it years before.
Oh, okay.
But still, got released in 86, and yeah, that's something to... Because we really were only scratching a little bit of it, scratching the surface of Alan Moore at that point in time, and then all of a sudden he was a household name amongst comic book readers.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, Nigel, what was it like? I mean, you were in England at the time?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say it's time to pour some cold water on all this excitement. I will start. I'm going to start back when I first read your message, Brian, about let's talk about is 1986 the greatest year for comics? And I thought 1986, and I thought about what I was reading at the time, and I thought, no, I can't say as I remember a lot of, you know, greatness in 1986. But bearing in mind what you have to remember or know about me is I wasn't a DC reader.
Mm-hmm.
So to start with then, all the things that came out from DC in that year, I didn't really either know about or I wasn't bothered about, which is, like my loss, as I know now. But so at the time, things like Batman, The Dark Knight Returns, you know, I was like, Batman, I didn't know he'd gone anywhere. Where's he returning from? Later on, like a couple of years after that, I learned more about what it was about and realized, oh, it's about like an older Batman coming back from kind of retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a little bit about the plot by then because it were being covered on TV shows and things like that. And I just thought, well, I don't like the sound of that anyway. So that never impressed me. Plus, it was Miller. I don't like Miller. So sorry, but boo-boo, that's one down. For me, it's not a big thing. So I don't miss that. And there was also Watchmen, which I didn't know anything about at the time. But I quickly found out about it, and I thought, no, that's not my thing. Because, well, both Batman Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen, they were kind of different. They were a deconstruction of the superhero concept as we knew it. They were dark and edgy, and heroes died and things like that. And I'm sorry, but I don't like that kind of story. So, I think the first thing I saw about Watchmen wasn't the comics. I saw the first part of the film when that came out. And I think I watched it for about half an hour, and then I thought, I've had enough of this. This is crap. So I don't like Watchmen either. So that was another one out the window. There's no impressing me there. Now, at the time as well, January 86. So I was only reading Marvel, really. And this was quite a low time for the amount of issues I were buying on a monthly basis. Because like a few years before this, like the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, I was getting comics in the double figures each month. I was sort of buying all sorts of titles. But by 1986, I was only actually reading about six titles. I was getting Avengers, Fantastic Four. Iron Man had just come back. I stopped getting that, but Iron Man I just started getting it again because it was after the Obadiah Stane thing. West Coast Avengers, Captain America, and Hulk. But of course, Hulk 318 was the first one in 86. Well, Byrne only had one more to go, and then he left the Hulk. So I left the Hulk as well, so that went. But of course, X-Factor came out, so I started getting that. But I was only reading about six issues a month, which means that most of the other things were not appealing to me, yeah? Just two examples. Brian's already mentioned Daredevil Born Again. Mm-hmm. Again, it's Miller, so I'm going to be like, and then that were dark, apparently, and I never read it, but I know about it. So I thought, no, don't like that. And Thor 366 was also another one that January 86. And what we got? Thunder Frog, for Christ's sake.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, come back, Howard the Duck, all is forgiven. I hate those kind of stupid things. So no, Thor, I never read the Simonson run. I didn't like it at all. So... That didn't impress me either. And then, as Brian had said before, Byrne leaves Marvel. And I've got in brackets here, hardly a good thing, is it? However, it was good for DC because Byrne joins DC and begins to do, Man of Steel and the Superman titles and the start of Legends and other such things. So, yeah, when I look at the DC stuff then, which I didn't read, there's tons of things that, I would have thought, oh, yeah, this is a good year. Because you got Legends, as I say, Action Comics, Superman, the new take on Wonder Woman with George Perez, Teen Titans stuff. X-Men became a franchise, although I wasn't reading them by then. So, again... didn't mean much to me because X-Men, had, for me, the best of the X-Men was over. there was Captain America when he had to. It was during the time when he gave up being Cap and became the Captain, and John Walker was doing the Captain America bit.
I don't think that it started just yet because this is just during the whole scourge. Storyline that was going
on. Well, I was wondering when you said that because I'd got this down as well. But yeah, I was getting it during the Scourge thing, definitely. Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
But it didn't pay off. That was my biggest argument.
What, Scourge? Yeah, it was a disappointing...
I mean, yeah. I recognized they were cleaning house and that they were going to be, you know, he was always going to escape off stage left constantly. Mm. So when they finally played the last card, it's like...
And then somebody shot him, But that's what got me. Like you say, they were supposed to be clearing house of, you know, what you'd call the lesser villains who they're not likely to use again anyway because they're a bit weak or whatever. But yet one or two of the people that he killed, one or two of the villains he killed, I thought, no, why did they kill that villain? I thought it was a good villain. So that annoyed me a bit, you know. It's like, I always remember, he killed the original Death Adder from the Serpent Society. And I thought, well, Death Adder's great. I liked the Serpent Society. Well, it was the Serpent Squad first. I thought Death Adder was cool because, like, he never says anything and he's got these poisonous, like, claws that, you know, is pretty dangerous. So I thought he was a good villain, shouldn't have been killed. Same with, mind you, I mean, I guess this guy was a bit lame by then, but the Melter, he's from way back. He's an old, the Melter.
Oh, the Melter, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did they get all these guys and not get Paystack Pete? Excuse me, the Trap.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's other guys who actually didn't get killed off, and you think they should have killed him or her.
Well, it was a hit list. Wasn't it? I've drawn a blank on who the creator, the editor was, who died early.
Grumold?
Yes, thank you. I should have known that name. He had a hit list, and it, you know, this was his baby and his idea, and he was going to take the following dozen or so off the table, which is a shame because I've heard people say there is no such thing as a poor character. They're just poorly written.
Or that's true.
Unimaginative creators who don't know how to breathe life into that character.
Yeah, because Burns proved that on many occasions.
But I think the thing is that there were so many villains... And, like, they killed, like, 22 of them at that bar.
In the bar with no name,
And but the thing is, like, for every one of those villains, there was somebody out there that had the same powers.
Yeah.
And so I think it was just basically, it wasn't like they were necessarily poorly written, though they were. It was that there were too many, you know, there's so much cross-pollination of these guys, you know, it's just better to go ahead and wipe these off the table so you've got the other ones to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
And now they're survived.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, for me, I believe I read somewhere, Dark Horse Comics started in July 86.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of another, like, set of comics. But... So for me, I think on reflection, was 1986 a great year? No, not for me, and certainly not for Marvel, I don't think. For DC, though, I would say, maybe so, and it's my fault that I missed out on it, because to begin with, as I say, Tim said earlier, when Byrne jumped ship to DC, Tim went with him. I wish I had, but I didn't. Because I thought, well, DC, I've never really read it. The only title I'd ever read from DC was New Teen Titans. And then he was going to Superman, which was not particularly my favorite character. So I didn't bother jumping over with him. Because I've often said, maybe if it had been Batman... I might have gone, but yeah.
Well, is it safe to say that maybe it? I agree a bit with you there, Nigel, that I wouldn't necessarily call 86 the greatest year in comic, but
no.
I think we could all say it was a significant year, especially for DC.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I would give them that. For DC, it was, yes. Yeah. Mm. But as I wasn't a DC fan at the time, you know, I mean, I can look back at it now in retrospect, but it's gone. So, yeah, it's like watching a great game of a sport years after it actually happened. Yeah, you see it and think, oh, yeah, that was good. But it doesn't mean the same thing if you weren't there at the time. Do you know
it's
what
hard
I mean?
To see it when you're kind of in it Radium Weekly. It's hard to pull back and look at them. Kind of what I was kind of looking at them over on Mike's Amazing World and looking at everything that came out every month. Like, oh, I remember that. I remember that. But when you're reading weekly, it's hard to kind of see the force because you're so focused on what you're reading.
Mm-hmm. And if you were a Spider-Man fan, 1986 was a very awesome year because you have the whole Hobgoblin mystery going on all through the year. Mm. You had Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz running Amazing Spider-Man. And while you had Peter David working, I think, on Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man. And I think David Michelinie and other writers were handling Web of Spider-Man. But for a good while there that year, all the books were involved in that Hobgoblin mystery. So you had Roderick Kingsley and Lance... Is it Lance Bannon?
Bannon, yeah.
And you know, several other people that you were thinking might be the Hobgoblin.
I think by then I was still reading Amazing, with DeFalco and Frenz, but I dropped the other two by then. Yeah.
And of course, it was like right after he'd gotten the black costume.
Yes. So
that's still a new thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was reading Spider-Man. Yeah, amazing.
Well, you know, Secret Wars 1 had not come out yet, right?
No,
it had.
In 84. So Secret Wars 2 was actually going on during 86.
Huh. I thought it just ended, didn't it?
Actually, I see now that
it ended, but
it ended on issue 9. Mm-hmm. And I think that came out in the summer.
It ended at the start of 86 because I wrote here that I was getting Avengers and I put the number down of that month's issue. It was 266, and that was like the aftermath of the Secret Wars 2.
Well, that's because that's when Byrne left Hulk. Was kind of, he tied up that with that a Beyonder issue, and then he went over to handed it over to Mantlo.
DP Sound.
Well, we had a, I don't know if anybody was reading, but I had started out reading Green Lantern, and we kind of had a new era because we had issue 199 and 200 where all the lanterns were stranded on Earth and they became the Green Lantern Corps and introduced them living kind of Avenger-like in a some little compound. And they were having little Earth-based adventures.
And that was with Kilowog and Chip?
Kilowog and Chip, the weird purple fish pickle-headed guy. I can't remember his name. The girl that...
Working.
Arisa,
who... Well, she aged herself up so she could date Hal. He had no problem with that.
Okay, my son went from like 5'2" to 6', but he was still 16 years old when it happened. You know, it you can grow, but you don't age. I mean, I understand what she was supposed to have done, but that was still just as creepy as all heck.
Very correct.
They did more to disservice to Hal Jordan in the 80s and 90s than so many other characters. I think the only other one that got his bad disservice was Iron Fist, and that happened in 86 when they ended the series of Power Man and Iron Fist, and they did it by killing Iron Fist.
Well,
thankfully, this writer-artist guy named John Byrne a couple years later was able to explain how it wasn't Iron Fist and that he was still alive.
It was a plant guy, right, Kirk?
He's pretty good at unraveling stuff and convincing you that it wasn't really the character you thought it was that died.
Everything you know is wrong. But that's what he was good at.
not necessarily maybe 86, but the mid 80s, we'll say 85, 86. To me, it felt like kind of an ending of maybe the Bronze Age and maybe almost the beginning of the modern age. Is that what we call it after the Bronze? Because you had a lot of books that were 70s books ending. Power Man, Iron Fist is one. Star Wars is one. You had Miller leaving Daredevil. You had Byrne is leaving. So it's almost like a lot of stuff is ending, and then the new era, which got better in the 90s, and then, of course, the 90s happened.
Well, the rise of the creator-owned properties and the independence, and in some ways that led, well, I'm not sure if I've got the sequence right, but the black and white glut that followed Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that huge boom. Are you guys familiar with that?
There was a lot of, you're talking about independence, yeah, the books I never read, but I'd heard of, like Nexus, Alien Legion, Cerebus, yeah.
And worst of them all, Troll Lords.
I read a book called Boris the Bear, which is a knockoff of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Flaming Carrot, those kind of books that were independent.
See, you've heard of them, but you haven't read them.
I've never
read
them.
And therein lies the problem. No, people were investing in them, buying them off the shelf in the comic book shops because they thought they were going to be the next big thing.
Yeah.
And as a result, the shops kept ordering huge amounts of them, thinking that they were going to ride the wave of the next big thing because they were just black and white books. But the art wasn't good, the stories weren't inspired, and nobody was reading them. All of a sudden, you had comic book shops that had tied up their overhead, their disposable cash, into huge quantities of these books that were just sitting there that they couldn't give away, and they started to go under.
Well, they were like considered more edgy, more adult. You know, they didn't. I don't think they had the comics code attached, so they could do things that normally couldn't do.
Exactly.
But
nobody was reading them. Nobody wanted them. And when that happened and the fans stopped buying them, the mom-and-pop smaller comic book shops were stuck. They were leveraged and they were folding. Like
that,
flies.
But I don't think that happened really, Kirk, until the speculator market of the early 90s where, you know, when like X-Men one came out.
It started earlier than that. It almost took the industry under. I can't tell you if it was 87 or 88, but believe me, in Detroit, we saw a huge number of shops that were flourishing in the heyday of 86, suddenly falling off.
Image came out.
They call it the black and white glut.
Right, but when Image came out and then Valiant, then it just boomed. That was early, 91, 92 when those came out?
Yeah.
Then the bat bubble broke and it all fell apart.
Yep. I remember about that time in the 90s, I was here in this city and I was working as a radio news person for a small family-owned radio station. And there, I was getting press releases or I was reading in Comic Buyer's Guide or wherever I was getting my information from that Marvel was selling stock in their company or corporation. And I was tempted to invest in it, but I didn't have a lot of spending cash because I was in a low-wage job. So I didn't. But I did ask the guy who was phoning in each day at noon for the stock market report. I asked him if he was familiar with this stock, and he said, no, he didn't know anything about it. So he said, do you want me to keep an eye on it for you? So he began reading amongst the various stock reports. Every day he was mentioning Marvel or whatever the parent corporation name was specifically, and partially to try to lure me in to invest. And I didn't. And I kind of kicked myself because they came in, they started at like $7 a share. I'm making this up. And then they went to $17 a share and then the 20s and they jumped to the 40s, and it, you know, was a success story, and it was a rising stock, and it was getting up to like $79 a share. And then somebody made a critical analysis of the company and said they have licensed all their characters out. There is nothing left. And boom, the stock started to tumble. So you had to have been out by then. And like a fool, I would not have been. So I'm so glad that I didn't ride that train. I'm sorry. Yeah. I got distracted on a memory. But that was like 91, 92. That's when Image Comics were beginning to come out, and everybody was swearing that was the going to be the big hot thing, and all these creators were going to teach Marvel and DC a lesson. And I don't know,
Wizard Magazine came out.
They were
that's that era.
And if they walked away from the company that made them hot, it just didn't quite seem fair to me.
Well, it was going to make them
buy
more
of their books.
Yeah, it was going to make them more money, and I don't blame them for wanting more control over their own stuff, but that was the beginning of the speculator market, you know, so I was guilty. I was buying every Image issue that came out, and then I jumped in on Valiant. I liked Valiant better. I thought the writing was better in Valiant.
That was where Jim Shooter went after he left.
Yes.
He started him and Bob Layton? No, yeah, it was Bob Layton. Actual Man of War.
Because Bob Layton stayed Marvel for a long time, and he had that 10-year run on Iron Man where he basically was to Iron Man what Joe Sinnott was to the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, he was, or what Walt Simonson was to Thor.
Joe Sinnott on Fantastic Four kept every other artist on model and making sure that the Fantastic Four looked like the Kirby version of them. You know, Reed Richards was very muscular, as was Johnny, you know. And when Bob Michelinie, Bob working on Iron Man, he was keeping, you know, he had John Romita Jr., Mark Bright, and a bunch of other artists come through. And he just kept making sure through his inks that that Iron Man looked like Iron Man.
Mm. Well, he kept a very techy. I always thought his artwork felt very technical and mechanical, which suited Iron Man very well.
Yeah. Whew. That was fun. Of course, in 86, this is when Denny O'Neil was actually writing Iron Man, and Tony was recovering. He was a recovering alcoholic after issue 200. And so that storyline went on for a while. Tony had already made the Silver Centurion armor.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he was getting ready to start the first armor wars. But that, I think, is when Dave Michelinie came and started writing. But, man, you know, Marvel actually had a bunch of crazy stuff happen during that year because they canceled Marvel Star Wars. They canceled Power Man and Iron Fist. And with issue 36, they canceled The Thing, though I think that was coinciding with Byrne leaving Marvel and not having a writer to sit there and take over the book. And, yeah, with 107, that's when Marvel canceled Star Wars in July. Actually, October is when the last issue would come out. So, I mean, you know, it looks like Marvel had a number of missteps while everybody else was, like, really, you know, DC and Dark Horse and other companies were actually getting a lot of stuff out there. I mean, because aside from Daredevil and Spider-Man, well, Captain America had some good stuff going on. Iron Man, I thought, I was reading Iron Man regularly, but I was not really impressed with Denny O'Neil's writing at this point. He'd had the gimmick a year or so before, or a couple years before, of getting Rhodey into the armor. And I thought that was really cool. But just the direction that it went there, it was almost like it was low-tech Iron Man, which when you read Iron Man, you're wanting to see high tech. And that didn't happen until after Stain was taken off the table and Tony started being Iron Man again.
Mm-hmm.
I did, even with the Silver Centurion armor, I just didn't feel like that was there yet. It wasn't until he went back to the red and gold that it felt right. But that's just my opinion. I could be wrong.
Well, Justice League was winding down too. I don't think it had quite ended, but it was.
You know what? That's a good question there. I'm going to take a look real quick because I think that's when they went to the Detroit.
I'm going to say, well,
it ended in
Legends, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And Legends.
With the beginning of Legends,
Towards the end of the year. So they all got killed.
Yeah.
During this year, and it's not even talked about in the list that I'm looking at.
But how many issues was Justice League Detroit running for?
Oh.
Well, they never actually called it Justice League Detroit, but it took their headquarters was moved to Detroit.
Yeah, well, believe me, living in the suburbs of Detroit, that's what we called it. Justice
League Detroit. That's
wasn't it the Great Lakes Avengers?
What's that?
Wasn't it the Great Lakes Avengers?
that's something else. That was pretty good.
261. It actually ended. It actually the final issue was actually January of the following year, 261, and it was a Legends crossover. So, and that's when the team was like none of the heavy hitters were there. It was Vibe. And Vixen and Aquaman was running out. Yeah, he was. Well, yeah.
What about
one of the lesser big hitters?
Marble Manhunter.
Yeah, no, the Justice League of America 233 was the first issue with the new team because it was like in an annual or special that they crowned the new team. And the book went on till issue 261. Which was the last issue, the final chapter, as they say. So they went on almost, 30 issues. So just like 2.5 years as Justice League Detroit. And I want to say, the annual number 2 is where Justice League Detroit premiered.
We had a really good turnout, good start with Wonder Woman. I was really excited to see that come out. I thought Perez did a really good job of reimagining her and reintroducing her to the new universe. I agree with Tim that this was basically the funeral service for the Bronze Age. You know, it was the end of the Bronze Age and it was the beginning of the next age, whatever we call it.
The modern era of comics.
Well, you were getting all those all the young guys that would jump over to Image, McFarlane and Larson and Valentino, all those guys were kind of starting out. I don't think
Jim Lee,
they haven't quite started doing their own stuff, but they had their foot in the door and the other guys were kind of getting pushed out.
Yeah. So Wonder Woman was really good. I think one of the better restarts from the crisis that came out, they really didn't have a firm idea of what they wanted. They wanted some restarted, some not. Don't mess with Batman or Green Lantern, but to everyone else we'll redo kind of.
That's
so.
I thought was odd. Not being a DC reader, that was I thought odd how they picked and choose.
Yeah. Well, that was good. I was happy with that.
Yeah. The thing is I remember during this time. During this year, kind of lamenting what Crisis was doing because it undid so many things that were part of, continuity. If you read the Batman books and Teen Titans, Dick Grayson had become Nightwing, and his origin as Nightwing was tied to Superman. And in the post-crisis continuity, it couldn't be because Superman was new. And by the time that we got to the post-crisis continuity, Dick Grayson was already no longer Robin, was already Nightwing. And they even changed how Batman and Robin had split as the dynamic duo. So that's one. I mean, there was a number of things that did suffer back then, but I'm trying to find what issues.
Was the Power Girl Aryan Lord of Atlantis connection 86? It was a post-crisis thing where.
Post-crisis thing. It would have been 87 or even 88.
That kind of broke too much for me when that happened. So.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. I'm. The Judas contract. No, it started in 84. Okay.
That was a perfect time for me to jump to DC because I didn't have a lot of baggage of being a DC reader to be angry about what they're doing. So I could start over. So when I was reading Superman and Legends and stuff like that, I was kind of introduced to these DC characters for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For someone who didn't grow up in the last 10 years reading that stuff, then that was definitely, what they wanted, a jumping on point. So,
yeah.
Well, the other thing that was going on at DC was what they'd done to Teen Titans and Legion of Superheroes. And I think that, if I remember right, that went into the year 86 because they had started printing both Teen Titans and Legion in Baxter format books. And they were a bit expensive. And they would then reprint that story in the regular continuity. It was like a year later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, what they did in Legion going up to the death of Karate Kid because they wanted to take a shot at Jim Shooter like everybody else then because he created Karate Kid. And what they did in Legion, in Teen Titans, I think that was when the Teen Titans all of a sudden became buddy-buddy with Deathstroke, during that period. But I'm kind of fuzzy on that because while I was reading it, I wasn't as engrossed in it as I had been previously. And I didn't like them becoming friends or whatever you want to call frenemies with Deathstroke.
I agree. There are some villains that you should not try to reform or sully your heroes with. The FF should never have been friends with Doom. Magneto coming to lead the school and the X-Men. While I read that and followed the logic, there are just some lines that you shouldn't cross.
Well, yeah. Kirk,
that's where I jumped.
Do you count Reed Richards going to school with Von Doom as being friends with him?
No, not at all. What I'm thinking of is FF number 116, where the Overmind has control of Reed and Sue goes to Dr. Doom and appeals to his pride and he refuses and then changes his mind, says, no, I'll do it. I'll come and help. And then he basically in 116 distracts the Overmind long enough for the Stranger to show, spoilers here, distracts him long enough that the Stranger can arrive and clean the Overmind's clock. So he just about gets killed, his armor is shredded, and he walks away from the team saying, you owe me one. But it's like, man, that was just a slap in the face. It was like, oh, the Lee Kirby era is over by 2 years now. I'm done. And I couldn't swallow that. It was like, somebody thought it was a brilliant move and great writing, but it's a case where, no, Doom would never have done that. He would have instead said, let Richards fail.
Well, correspondent, don't you think Doom it would be more of a boost to his ego to think that Reed couldn't do it on his own. He had to come to me.
Yes, but I still don't buy it. If he's a villain who's been trying to kill that team, I cannot see him turning and saying, oh, I'll come in and save you guys. I mean, some people have told me, well, he did it because the Earth was going to perish, that he was at stake, that his, you know, his Latvia, his country, his people were at stake as well. It's like, okay, I follow that, but you know, the character that you painted as being vain and arrogant and having this abiding hate for Richards and Richards' team, I cannot see that ever. That's just me. I'm way off on a tangent now. Has nothing to do with Byrne, but jeez.
Go ahead, Nigel.
I was just going to say I agree with Kirk. Yeah, when they do these kind of things like that, that's just one example. It's like you say, some villains are villains for good. And yeah.
I
couldn't see Doom helping them, really.
But what about when Richards went to, when Sue is dying and giving birth, about to give birth, and he goes to Doc Ock?
Yes, I thought it was brilliant.
That was good.
That's okay.
Doc Ock was not an opponent of the FF. Doc Ock was never, in their world, a villain. Reed worked his psychology on him, talked him down, and got him there. Too late. I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was a terrific story.
Yeah, I agree. I love that story.
With it after the fact to try to turn the clock back and have... I don't know exactly how they got Valeria, but, you know, I was off the book by then. But however they did that...
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was a mistake.
That just tears the guts out of that story.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with Magneto, I think that even though Chris Claremont wrote it, he kind of tried to sidestep the fact that Magneto killed like 80 Navy men.
Yeah.
He was put on trial. In what, issue 200, right? He was put on trial?
That was what, X-Men versus Avengers?
No, that was issue 200. He was put on trial.
Yeah, yeah.
He was on trial in 200.
Yeah, I know he was on trial in 200, but the trial got messed up because of Fenris, and
right.
they finished the trial in X-Men versus Avengers.
Did they?
Yeah.
Possibly. Well, they did similar, the films did similar waffling, because Magneto would be kind of, oh, I'm going to settle down and I'm going to have a quiet life. Then he would turn bad again. And then Xavier would reach out to him and say, no, we've got something in common. You work with us. Okay, I'll work with you. And then the next movie, he's a bad guy again. So,
yeah. Crazy.
And Magneto is probably the one that is flip-flopped the most of any major villain. Yeah,
they literally split him into two characters so you could have your cake and eat it too. I mean, that got really messy.
Well, when he was Zion, or what was his name?
Strife.
Oh, well, I was thinking, yeah. But I was thinking about when Quietly was on the book and they had this, his name's Zorn. He was a guy with a metal mask, and it turns out he was Magneto under that mask.
Yes. Strife. He fed them a line of BS that he had to wear the mask so that they wouldn't recognize him. I thought that was pretty good writing. Well, have we covered 1986?
Seems like it.
I mean, we covered it a lot, but I'm sure there are people going, no, you missed this, you missed that.
Well, they can write in and tell us.
That's right. Brian, how can they get a hold of us?
Well, hold on, I'm not done yet.
Ooh.
I was saying, you guys seem to forget Alpha Flight in issue 33. That was the first appearance of Lady Deathstrike.
Yeah.
And she's become someone that we've seen in animated features now. Mm-hmm. We've seen her in X-Men 2. And it's funny because her character actually started out in Daredevil back in the days when I think Denny O'Neill was writing it. And somehow she turned into, got turned into a mutant killer.
Mm.
But again, I've never really, I've got a copy of that Alpha Flight issue. It's issue 33. But I've never read it. I love the cover, though, with Mike Mignola's art. But does anybody know the story in that very well?
No.
No. No. Alpha Flight finished at 29.
You're right. Yeah. You're right.
I don't know, it was a couple years before, but once Byrne left, the art and the writing just didn't keep my interest after that. It's the same with Namor, the Submariner. After he left, I really tried with Jay Lee and what was going on, and it just didn't work for me. So, yeah.
But
Brian, you're also forgetting that 86 brought us Apocalypse.
Apocalypse?
X-Factor.
Yep.
Well, hold on a second. No, the summer of 86 was Mutant Massacre.
Yes.
He had an unnamed appearance in Marvel Graphic Novel number 17. But his cameos in X-Factor 5 and full appearance X-Factor 6. So
now was the Mutant Massacre, was that after, I guess, after Secret Wars and Secret Wars 2, that was then the summer event?
Yes.
And that Mutant Massacre like ran, Mutant Massacre was October to December.
Yeah. Well,
86.
No, that was the publication date, but the actual on sale date was 3 months. Am I getting that right?
Yes. You're right.
I think it came out during the summer. It actually happened during the summer, but the publication date was different. But I would have thought it would have been 3 months earlier.
It was the first
crossover, as far as I was concerned, that the storyline and thread that you could read flowed somewhat naturally into a couple of other books if the creator wanted to tie in. But you didn't have to read that to enjoy the main thrust through the X-Men books. And as you come out the other end, Warren has been maimed. Some things that were serious have happened, but you didn't have to buy every single book in the entire Marvel line to follow the story. So it was the first crossover event that, in my estimation, worked.
Yeah, because I remember the Daredevil book had Sabretooth in it. Thor actually was in his book. He had an experience down there in the Morlocks tunnels, and he wound up cleaning them out using his lightning to clean out the tunnels. But the other thing that was, of course, that happening that year was the return of the original X-Men in X-Factor.
Oh, God.
So we had the return of Jean Grey in that year. What's wrong?
You said.
Was it bringing back Jean Grey? Was that just a step too far?
No, I loved it.
It was convoluted, but
that made sense.
Yeah, I could handle and accept the fact, since it was Byrne that had the idea and showed them how to do it. But to demutinize
Busiek's the beast, idea.
To turn him back into a pink-skinned human, I'm sorry, that was a step too far for me. And the motivation of Cyclops to rejoin the team but not tell his wife that his original love was... I mean, boy, were people out of character.
Woo!
Well, they pretended to be... Didn't they pretend to be hunters. Like mutant hunters? But really, they were...
Yeah.
Because Angel wore that backpack that disguised his wings.
Yeah. Yeah, that didn't hold well for very long. I think it was like, a year, maybe two?
No, less than that.
Not even that. Yeah.
6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all that started, that was just getting going. It started in 85 is when the issues came out for those. But yeah, they it kind of... I thought it was cool at the time when they brought her back, and I liked X Factor. But when thinking of, because I was just excited to have Jean back, but
yeah, me too.
As you said, it wasn't really Jean, and it was a whole lot different. And I think it really undermined the
Dark Phoenix.
137, the original, what they did. So for me, it undermined the impact of that story. And
it sure did.
So. But, I mean, for me, it doesn't undermine the story at all. I guess I've been able to separate all that. I mean, Crisis in itself I took the DC Universe in a direction I didn't want it to go. Now, that being said, I really enjoyed Man of Steel. I really enjoyed and all the Superman books that came from that. I really enjoyed Wonder Woman. I really enjoyed The Dark Knight Returns, Batman Year One. I was enjoying so much of those books afterwards, but I could still see where the DC Universe was not this cohesive thing that we had before, even though what we had before was like so many different Earths and so many different realities. I was able to keep track of it all. And I was kind of like insulted when they felt like, we know we got to, you know, just take it down to one universe. Now they say one, but it was actually two because of Captain Carrot. But they felt that they had to do that so the readers wouldn't have a hard time figuring it out. And I just, again, I thought that was insulting. They didn't need to do that. Now, restarting Superman, they should have restarted him right as they finished, you know, Crisis. Instead, they gave him, what is it, 6 months or a year later, and they finally did Man of Steel. The last two issues, there was one in Action and one in Superman. The Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, Alan Moore wrote it. Kurt Swan did the pencils in the first one, and George Perez did the inks. And he told a story of something that just doesn't happen in Superman comics, you know?
Everybody talked about that issue with such great reference. I mean, I've never read it, and I've wondered, why is that so special? Why is it held in such high regard?
It's the only reason, I think, number one, it's the end of that Superman mythos, as far as, you know, anybody's concerned. Two, it's got Alan Moore writing it. And beyond that, there's no other reason that I could sit there and look at that and say it deserves any reverence. Fact of the matter is that after I finally got to, I was able to find 383, Superman 383, but I had a heck of a time finding Action 583. And it was several months after, you know, Man of Steel and several issues of Superman and all the other books had come out before I actually found it to finish it. And I was so underwhelmed. I just was like, seriously? This is it? I don't understand the reverence that people put to it. No.
I don't remember. I'm going to backtrack to X-Factor. When they brought Jean Grey back, was that when they started referring to her just as Jean Grey and they dropped the Marvel Girl
name? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, which carried over. Yeah. I never understood that in the movies. In the movies, she's always Jean Grey. Everybody else has a code name, but not her.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's silly.
Well, I think part of that is she was the doctor. She, in the movie, in the Marvel Universe, she was the medical person back at the mansion.
Yeah, but she went out on assignments and with a costume. Yeah,
I guess she did.
I mean, and if they wanted to do what they did with Sue and not call her Marvel Girl, I mean, Marvel Woman doesn't sound right, but give her a new new name. They can call her Ms. Marvel.
Maybe they call her Dr. Marvel.
Well, she could have stuck with Phoenix because she did rise from her own death. Mm. So they could have stuck with Phoenix. But then they had her daughter, Rachel.
Is it Rachel? Rachel
came Summers, along and she was Phoenix later on. So,
yeah. Oh, it was just so convoluted, so crazy, but so fun. And I'm sure that we could have as interesting discussion about any other year. I just found this one to be so, like, wow. Just so many things that happened. And, of course, you have to look at, you know, just the Alan Moore and Frank Miller aspects of it. But there were other really good creators. I mean, and John Byrne and George Perez and Matt Wagner. I mean, if you ever read, like, the Mage, The Hero Reborn, The Hero Discovered. Fact is, I think that The Hero Discovered came out in December.
It ended in December. The final issue of Madge, The Hero Discovered, was published in December of 86.
As was Blue Devil with issue 31. And I love Blue Devil. But that being said, yeah, I mean, I think I've said pretty much what I wanted to say. It was 26 years for Marvel, 25 years for Marvel. It was a red letter year for DC. And, you know, the big creators. Have we had a year as big as this since then?
I mean, I think it depends on who you ask, because if you ask people about the New 52 or about things like that, they will say, you know, it depends on who you are. For us, probably so. For our age group, and for those who collected and read at that time, yes, I think so. But if you ask younger readers who didn't grow up with that or have that type of a transition, they might say something different.
Mm. Yeah, I was reading it. I read an article about on Google about what people thought, because 86 was mentioned. And there was somebody who said, they chose 2006, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, I wasn't really reading anything at that time, so I don't know what was out there.
I think that was Final Crisis, because that's when they, at that time, ended the Byrne era Superman and went on to whatever was next.
Was when did...
No.
When was Brand New Day? That was a big turning point that ticked off a lot of people.
So, yeah, it depends.
Yeah.
But 86, 85 and 86 were definitely a pivotal point and a change in how comics were written, drawn, and read, I think. Mm-hmm. Right.
Certainly a turning point.
Turning point year, yeah.
But well, we're getting ready to go into the grim and gritty. So the elements may have been sowed in that year, but yes, it's, you know, 86 was a high watermark. I agree.
Well, we're getting into the, and this really took force with Image and the rest of the artist being, I mean, before this, I mean, I think it was writing and artist both, but there was a point in the early 90s where the artist was king, and that what drove the book. They didn't care about the writing. As long as it looked pretty, that's all that mattered. And I think that changed in the 2000s where writers became more popular and the art kind of took a back seat.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any, since the turn of the millennium, are there any new writer artists? Because I can't think of anybody that has come into the business that does that. I mean, in the 80s, we had so many. You know, with Simonson, with Byrne, with Miller, with Perez. And
not doing both. So, I can't think of anybody who does both.
And McFarlane tried to do it himself, and your results vary.
Well, if you're looking for a big name, Brian Michael Bendis and his 7-year run with Secret Invasion, I think that was unprecedented. Love him or hate him.
Well, he did Ultimate Spider-Man. He did Powers. I loved his Powers run.
Yeah, Powers was good. But what I'm asking is, are there any writer artists since the turn of the millennium?
I don't think so. I don't. I think it's done so much now that you can't get a regular writer and artist team. You have a writer, but they cycle through artists because the pressure of getting the book or the time to get the book out. it's rare to have two guys that will stay on a book for a while.
All right.
When I look back on you know, my comic buying experience, the things that I value the most were when they had a stable creative team that lasted, so I knew issue after issue I was going to get the same flavor, I was going to get the same visuals, maybe not the same story arc, that might have been shorter or longer, but I knew what I was going to get next month as long as that team was together. And it seemed like they were in longer periods of time than they are now. Like, it maybe there were year-long contracts, I don't know. Maybe it was two-year contracts. It just seemed to me the stuff that I have valued over the decades has been when I've been able to point to a title and know who the writer artists were, what the team was. Yeah, I don't know if I can explain it any better than that.
All right. Well, let me ask Nigel, did you have any last thoughts as we kind of wrap this one up?
Any last thoughts? Well, about, as I say, about 1986, no, I pretty much decided that, you know, for me anyway, it wasn't a great year. And as I said, but in retrospect, with regard to DC, which I didn't read at the time, which I now know a lot more about, yeah, I'd probably say that for them, for DC, 86 was an important and a good year. But that's all. It doesn't really stand out for me in any other way. My sort of favorite era, and I would never try to choose just one year, actually, because I don't think there's enough going on in one year to ever say it's the greatest year. But one of my favorite periods, and of course this is mainly Marvel, I would say from like 1977 to 82 is a good year for the amount of really good stories and artwork and the creation of new characters and titles. That's sort of my favorite era.
Cool. John?
I was doing a lot of travel because I was in the military, so I wasn't reading a lot of things consistently, and because they just weren't that easily available. But and at the time, it didn't stand out. It was just another year for me. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of changes, a lot of interesting things happening, like with Superman and Wonder Woman over on the DC side, because they had created a space where that needed to happen. And over at Marvel, it just kind of plugged along in different ways. I thought the X-Factor started off as an interesting concept, and I was looking forward to seeing that. And so, yeah, I mean, overall, you know, it was just, I was very selective. I mean, I read DC and Marvel both all the time, so I'm not an either-or person from those eras. And I just think overall, you know, I was picking out what I enjoyed reading, and if I didn't like it or didn't think it was going to be interesting, I just didn't get it, even if it was the cool thing, like Watchmen. I mean, I was like, I don't think this will be for me, so I didn't read it until years and years later. And so, you know, if it interested me, I just read what I liked, and I thought it was, you know, I mean, to me, it was just another year, because I wasn't heavily into the comic scene. I was just picking up a few things that were kind of holdovers from what I enjoyed reading from years before.
Fred?
86 was probably the high point of my comic buying career. I was junior in college. I'd been reading for a couple years. I remember all of it very fondly. I was reading mainly for story, not so much for name of creators. So I was reading a diverse selection. It wasn't just DC or Marvel. you know, I remember Watchmen. I remember the buzz around Watchmen. I remember the buzz, like, every time, like, Booster Gold came out and, you know, all the posters in the store. And, you know, I remember those days fondly because I remember the community around the store was a big deal. And I, after I graduated college, my buying kind of petered off to nothing. It was harder to get to a store, and I kind of missed it, but I moved on at that point. But 86 was a real highlight for me in a lot of titles.
Well, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Tim?
I'm going to echo a lot of what Fred said. This was kind of the height of my, because I started reading comics late. I didn't read them as a kid, so I've been reading them probably for maybe 3, maybe 4 years. And it was the height of that, going to having your pull list and going every, gosh, I think at that time it was Thursday. I think it was Thursday when the comics came out, Wednesday. And picking them up, taking them home, and usually reading all of them that night. Thumbing through them, all of them, reading them, bagging them, you know. So I missed that. I kind of missed, and to your point also, Fred, of the kind of community involved around a brick-and-mortar store. You know, you would see, you go there, and everybody's there because they're all picking their books up. And then you could, you know, I was going to a store called The Comic Strip in Denton, and it was run by kind of an old hippie guy and his wife. And he was great. He would sit there and, you know, if it wasn't busy, he would just talk your ear off about comics. And he was good about, if you wanted something and you couldn't afford it, he would let you take it, and he would write it down. And when you came in the next time, you just pay for it with your extra. So we kind of let you have stuff on, you know, on credit.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, you know, because he just loved the he loved comics, and, you know, that was his, that was his thing. So I kind of missed that you don't have a lot of that. And even in a lot of the new stores now, or even if you go into them, it feels very corporate and not mom and pop. So
it's a business.
Yeah. Because it's all Funkos and yeah. Luckily if the guy behind the counter knows anything about comics, they're just there to, nothing against them, they're just there to make a buck. But I kind of missed that day of going and getting your, you know, getting your fix every week to get your books.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did we get everybody?
How about you? Did you go over yours, Brian?
Well, I kind of, you know, went over that, you know, earlier. But what you're talking about there, the community at the comic book shop, it was something, you know, you go in there and meet new people and make new friends. And, you know, I had other things happen. It's like I had a car break down in the parking lot where the clutch wouldn't go any further. It was my dad's 64 Chevy, so that was a lot of fun. and it wasn't just that we would go to the comic book shop. We'd spend a good while there, and then right across the street was a Putt-Putt with its arcade, and then we'd go there and spend a lot of that wasted youth money there.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you know, it was a great time. Of course, you know, it's like when you're in your from 16 to 20 and you're just enjoying that before you know reality really starts to hit you, which it took a few years for it to hit me, but you know, that's what the first wife does for you. But yeah, I look back at this year and I remember so much from it. I remember getting home and realizing that one of my copies of Man of Steel had two covers on it.
Ooh.
And the other thing we didn't mention here, of course, is the fact that Man of Steel number one was the first comic to have a variant cover. Mm-hmm. And so there it was, 1986. Gave us so much. Just really cool.
Now you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a variant cover.
And it's like, you know, we've been looking at the Godzilla versus books that have been coming out lately, and they got a variant cover for every issue, it seems. Oh, And yeah, Chris really wants to get every single one of them. But nope, we establish limits. Anyway, that's mine. I'm trying to see, is there anything else or anyone else has any thoughts, concerns, comments?
If we're wrong and our listeners think we've missed something, how can they get a hold of us?
Oh, they could write us. They could write us at, what is that? GottaGetBurned@gmail.com. They could write us on Facebook, on our Facebook group, Third Degree Burn, right out there. We're waiting. Tell us something. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. And lastly, the iTunes or Apple podcast, formerly iTunes. You can leave us ratings and reviews there. We'd love a 5-star review there because that's what increases our visibility to other possible listeners. Now, I'm wanting to fix our feed because right now our feed is not getting updated properly there. And I'm trying to work with Chris Honeywell to see what we need to do there. So that may be forthcoming. Some people have been asking about that. So
now on our Facebook page, we've recently asked the question, what do you want us to do next? We are still in the middle of our Alpha Flight coverage, but looking towards the future, if you want to vote on that poll, it is on our Facebook page, and there are something like 7 different options, or you can add your 8th one if you have a different opinion, but we'd like to hear from you. Right now, there is not a clear runaway winner, so I won't run down the list, but take a look and tell us what you want us to cover next.
Cool.
Well, I want to thank the panel here for joining us for this hour and a half discussion of the greatest year in comics, debatable, of course. I want to thank Brian and Tim and Fred and John and Nigel. And I'm Kirk Greenfield. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Hideous slaying of a group last night, the latest in a brutal crime spree.
Crime is at a record high in Gotham, and no one seems to be doing anything about it.
Tonight also marks the 10th anniversary of the last sighting of the Batman.
The time has come. People have given up, Jim.
These are scary times.
I got the little one.
I'm sitting atop the Gotham Life Building with 2 bombs.
He's become consumed by his dark side.
Bring me the head of the Batman!
There must be thousands of them.
He is a monster.
I will tear him limb from limb!
Do you know who I am?
They call us a gang.
I'm your worst nightmare.
They think we're just noisy kids. I will show you who rules Gotham City.
Okay, son, show me.
Prepare for war!
He's in his prime. He'll kill you.
Gotham City belongs to the mutants! Ain't you got the stomach for it?
The war goes on.
Last call for alcohol, so finish your whiskey or beer. Closing time, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22 Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's GOTTAGETBYRNED@gmail.com.
Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Until next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.